WBTA station at 9 o'clock. From there, people will ride about 28 miles to the historic Mill Village and Canal Museum on the Mill Pond in North Villarica. They'll make a lunch stop, so it's recommended that people who are coming bring a lunch. We're going to stop at a number of remnants and restored sections of the canal, as well as the mansion of Lamy Baldwin, the chief engineer of the canal. And just in case you don't know, the canal was the big dig of the end of the 18th century, and it connected the Merrimack River in what is now Lowell with the Charles River at Sullivan Square in Charlestown. And the next piece of news...
The second announcement is that the Palestine Freedom Walk will be on Saturday, October 10th, 2009, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. in Boston. You will meet at 1 p.m. at the corner of Beacon Street and Webster Street in Coolidge Corner in Brookline. And T-shirts and leaflets will be distributed. They will walk in silence for 2.5 miles to the square in front of Trinity Church, Coupley Square. It is flat terrain and there are sidewalks the entire way. Feel free to carry a Palestinian flag and wear a kafir if you like. Just know the signs or banners.
Also, in case you didn't know, this week is going to be Poverty Action Week at MIT, which is really exciting, and it's done by the Global Poverty Initiative, which is a student group at MIT. And on Tuesday, there's going to be a keynote speaker featuring Dr. John MacArthur and Anita Sharma on the Millennium Development Goals. It's going to be at 3 p.m. in Kresge Auditorium. Another interesting thing is that every day there's going to be a GPI information group booth, a GPI bag sales, and poverty action organizations around the world are going to be displayed. There's going to be Fair Trade Bazaar raffle tickets, and all of that's going to be Lobby 10 and Lobby 7. And there's also going to be a fundraising luncheon next Saturday, October 17th, called Eat So They Can, and it's going to be at the Kresge Oval starting at noon.
The last announcement is also from MIT. On Tuesday, October 15th, there will be an event called Hands and Health, the 2010 UNUS Innovation Challenge, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at R&D Commons on the fourth floor of Sata Center. Apply your hands and mind to the 2010 UNUS Challenge, focusing on clean hands for disease prevention. The kickoff dinner will feature a keynote speaker, a mixer, and plenty of time to pitch your ideas and skills.
Thanks for listening to our show today. We have to go. We'd like to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR or the Technology Broadcasting Corporation or MIT. We'll talk to you guys next Friday. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Adios. Yes, yes, marhaban to you. I am a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and here I am once again welcoming you. Welcoming you here to Music for Human. Did you hear my name? Names are such fickle, unusual things. Once again, I am a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and once again, I welcome you here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age talk radio with an emphasis on you. I think you may have heard there, Aurora.
Yes, you did, unless you were deaf.
Aurora, you are you not a speech specialist?
I am a speech therapist. I specialize in the therapy of the human soul through speech and sound.
It's rough sometimes being a human soul.
It is always rough being any kind of soul. And yet we are caught up in the overthinking and trying to stay only in the physical plane. And I find it is wonderful to bring a soul back into the transcendence of all of the planes and spirituality and the chakras united in happiness.
Well, that sounds all well and good, but what if you are, as our colleague here tonight is, without a soul? How do you answer that, Mr. Five?
Well, the soul is a mutable thing, and it's always up to interpretation, if you have one. And if not, where the closest one is that you can...
just latch on to that near soul, and you can wander through life like a soul, without right. a soul.
I believe that our definition of soul must be redefined here. What we have, the soul, this label is just a oneness that we all are connected with, a base, sort of intangible, ineffable feeling of commonality, that we are all one and we are all entangled.
It's really a confused picture, because if we are all entangled, then why, it's like spaghetti. But perhaps it is more like we are all one soul, more like the ocean.
Yes, it is like the ocean, but you notice that in the ocean there are spaghetti-like elements such as octopuses and squid that feel one another and flow with one another in the circle of life.
They flow together and they sort of undulate together.
And become entangled with one another. It's like entangled states in quantified mechanics.
But these entangled states, they still have a single source. Is that not right?
They have overlapping sources. Sources that touch and affect one another. This is not a perfect analogy.
But you can always take an octopus out of some water as an individual octopus. Don't forget that.
Yes, you can, but then you must label it as an octopus out of water. If we allow ourselves to be labeled as elements within the ocean, then all will be well.
But the octopus has its limits. It still evolves because it is evolving to someday either one of two natural extremes. Eight, as we know, is not itself a destination. It is either arriving or departing.
Well, this is part of the flow, Dr. Jalis.
As we've discussed earlier, all of us are arriving and departing and constantly evolving and changing and improving and deproving. That we are all following the same path ultimately.
But like a circle, if you zoom in close enough, nothing is changing on that circle.
It's a constant line. If you zoom out far enough, all is uniform and beautiful.
Yeah, my vision on the octopus is simply that with eight legs and another eight arms, the natural destination is either that it loses seven arms and becomes a uni-armed creature, the unipus, or alternatively, it grows many, many more arms, all of them of very large length, but very thin, which we would, I assume, likewise call the omnipus.
Well, it's a question of where the creature wants to go.
And that's not really a choice of direction for a single creature. It is simply nature's choice, nature's plan for the octopus itself. I mean, a question that I think very few could answer is how many teeth does the octopus have? Does it have eight teeth? That is one per leg, per tentacle?
I think they have one tooth.
They are unitoothed.
The unitooth unipus.
Or the omnitoothed omnipus.
Yes.
It occurs to me that if you had a mouth full of teeth, that's just like having a single tooth. So there's some unity there in the limit. That instead of having, you know, infinity minus one teeth, is a single tooth with a cavity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if... If it's a unipus, then the plural would be unipi. Or unipi.
Well, the number of teeth actually, it really greatly affects how the creature expresses itself vocally with sounds. It's not just an oral fixation or a chewing sort of thing. It's much more of expressing how the resonances of the creature's sounds through its mouth are affected.
Now, do octopus communicate in the water with sounds or with vibrations, or can those be differentiated in water? Or
well, what I usually deal with are resonances, which contain all sorts of waves. They can communicate by splashing their arms around, or
by slapping the water's surface.
Yes, which is essentially the same as the vibrations of our vocal cords.
The medium of water is also better suited for the transmission of information through the use of sound. So, you know, or something analogous to sound. So I think we could all very well imagine that the unipus would communicate with other unipi through the use of some sort of wiggling about message, much like the bee.
Right.
And I recently met with some very unusual news. I think everyone here knows that a lot of my work occurred in Bonn. Some 30, 40 years ago or earlier. And I recently was notified. So when I moved from Bonn to Boston, I was notified that I placed many of my possessions, personal possessions and those that were related to my work into a storage facility in Bonn. And, you know, I paid the fees that would certify that until I died, that my possessions would be taken care of. But recently this company that held my possessions was, it went out of business, as they call it in Bonn, and they were forced to dispose of all of my possessions in an auction, which is a very difficult experience for one who, you know, cannot travel to Bonn, so I could not go there and personally purchase those possessions. And it's a little bit disturbing to me that those things are gone.
Yet it could be a freeing experience, Dr. Jalas.
You mean no longer having a connection to that time and to that place?
And to freeing yourself from the physical associations.
And yet, ever since I received this notice, I found myself returning to that time and to that mindset that I had in that area, thinking about teeth, a lot about teeth, and about flavor sensations and the experiments I was doing on vagabonds and street toughs that would threaten me, and whom I would then capture and place in my power and return to my laboratory where I would perform various experiments, and the results of which were published in many notable journals. But as I said, I was forced to leave the original dental plates and the wiring that I added to them. I was forced to leave all of these things in Bonn, and now they are being sold on the market, on the open market, and I wonder, you know, who would purchase these items, you know, and what would they do with them? These are sort of scientific artifacts.
I find it interesting that the reemergence of your mental associations with such a time are coincidental with your lack of physical evidence of them. I believe that letting go of those physical artifacts has allowed those memories to be added to your mindset, which in the end is a great thing. And I would try not to worry too much about the purchaser or nefarious deeds that are going to be done using your belongings.
Well, if you or anyone else has purchased one of my old scientific relics or are interested in helping me recover them, call into to the show and join in our discussion here. It's 617-253-8810. Yeah, I remember an old Well, it looks like we have our first caller.
Hello,
caller. Marhaban.
Hello.
I have a cleft soul.
You have a cleft soul?
Yes.
Now, caller, and this is a good reminder for all of our callers, please turn your radio down.
Oh, no, I believe that's my soul.
Your soul is cleft?
Yes, it produces a feedback of sorts.
A cleft soul. Is it all the way cleft, like right completely, two souls, or is it attached a little bit at the end? Is there like a little bit that...
It's slightly attached at the base.
Yes, I was going to say usually these resonance effects occurs with souls that are slightly attached and trying to produce the same sort of sounds and spirituality at the same time.
Yes, it's like they communicate.
It sounds quite a bit more disturbing than just having two souls.
Yes, it's rather disturbing.
Well, how did this come about, caller?
It all really happened on this journey that I once had.
A journey?
Deep into a cave. It was very difficult for me. It's hard to talk about.
Caller, have you been performing immoral deeds or deeds that do not jive with the New Age philosophies?
I'm not really at liberty to speak about what happened in the cave. I'd rather have a lawyer present.
You must regain equilibrium within yourself.
Yeah, and caller, I mean, realize that it's perfectly anonymous. You know, we have all of your personal information here and your phone number, but, you know, other than that, we have no way of contacting you or in bringing any illegal acts that you may have committed home, and so therefore no charges could be brought to bear against you.
Really,
you know, we're only concerned with helping you and helping you overcome this difficulty in either having your soul completely split into two pieces so that you can take one of them and put it in a bottle and make strawberry milk out of it, for instance, and then merge it back with the original soul, or digest it and bury it and, you know, be at an end.
Those seem like very holistic approaches.
And the alternative, if it's mostly attached, which it does not sound like it is, would be to try to sew the two pieces together, which would probably cause a great deal of physical pain, but emotionally would be really rewarding. So
That could be very rewarding. What I fear is that my soul will become somewhat of an omni-soul, almost as you were talking about with the octopus.
Precisely.
It may split off more so.
Well, it's unlikely, but I have seen this effect that occurs where it's as though the soul were being pushed through a spaghetti machine, and the result is a real blooming of many-faceted hair soul.
Like a meat grinder.
A meat grinder.
Well, caller, this all can be solved if you resolve the immoral deeds, and I recommend you go to a vocal therapist in your local area, as we have specialties in recombining souls and sort of gluing them together into a oneness again, using your own vibrations.
Yeah, and Aurora, I'm sure you can hear in the caller's voice the...
A certain desperation and a cleaved nature.
And the dissonance, the two frequency separations there.
I'm very deprived.
Right.
I just need some advice on certain adhesives I could use, if you know of any.
Well, now, caller, I mean, it seems to me that the cleft is almost complete. I would actually advise cutting the remaining bit off, and then we'll see if it's, you know, right down the middle, or if it's just a little chunk.
Yes. I might try that. Are there certain tools I could use?
If you can find that cave again, I think that might be your answer.
We could also use meditation and attempt to sing in your falsetto voice, a sort of screaming dissonant sound that usually aids in the ripping of one's soul.
Yes. I'm actually entering another cave of sorts. The Sumner Tunnel. I'm paying my toll, so I'll probably have to go now.
Well, thank you for joining us, caller. I think that paying that toll may, in fact, tear off the last bit of your soul there.
Hopefully it releases me.
Hopefully, and...
Feel free to call us next week or at a later time in order to make sure that you are okay and whole again.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope to speak to you soon.
Alright then. My salama, caller.
Have a good evening.
Yes. Yeah, it's always difficult to deal with the case of cellular separation, you know, a failed split. Many things could cause this. You know, for instance, it could be that the caller was about to give birth to a demon in another dimension. Let's bring another call in. Caller 2, welcome. Caller 2?
Hello. I just wanted to say, I'm sorry you lost your stuff.
Thank you. Thank you, caller. It's tragic a little, but as Aurora has said, there is a way that... I'm really just worried that people will use, like, I built a silver retainer with many wires attached to it for one of the patients, and I kept that as a keepsake. Once his teeth were straightened and we also recovered his sense of taste, I had kept that, and I'm worried that people will use it to, you know, as a device I think torture is a strong word, but certainly extreme annoyance.
Well, I think it's time to let go of the past. I think this is a good thing to have happen, to lose your stuff. It might be very meaningful and help your soul.
Yeah, I think there's hope there. It's just difficult to let go. I remember my father and how he always, on the one hand, would tell me that he would say, Jalis, you know, life is a test, and you shouldn't hold anything on this earth too tightly. But at the same time, I remember his affinity for his blue Mercedes.
Losing your stuff is very interesting. It could be a very meaningful and educational thing. I once took a flight to Michigan and lost my stuff entirely. Everything I owned was in a canvas bag, and it was lost.
Wow.
As I said before, such losing things can be such a freeing experience. I oftentimes go on nature hikes that last weeks with almost no belongings, just so that I can experience the freedom of no cell phone, no laptop.
There's a movement there also, right? The minimalist movement?
Yes, exactly.
Which basically espouses this idea that anything you want should become part of you. So if you need to have a calculator, then just try to, you know, remember or to train yourself to add quickly and dispense of the need. Likewise, the need for other possessions like books. You read the book and really try to focus once so that you can pass the book down and not have to be burdened with a large number of material possessions. The knowledge that the change that it makes to you is something that you can keep. But
yeah, it's very zen to experience having nothing.
I think so. I think there is something to that. But it has been perhaps 30 years since I have even looked at all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very, very large house in Bonn.
Mm-hmm.
So, which was full of this nonsense. And when I left, and even now, I never bothered in having anything more than a roof over my head. It is always, you know, important, I found, to keep things light. And I never returned to that state. But it really is a difficult experience, losing all of these things. How did you... Were your things ever restored to you?
Never. No, the airline sent me a check for $250.
And what did you do with the money there?
I bought a few necessities. It didn't cover what was in the canvas bag, but I called my children, who were grown, and told them, and they all laughed. because I told them I was a minimalist, and it proved to be true.
And from that moment, you became a minimalist?
No, I think it's sort of...
It was a gradual thing?
Yes, and it was total. The airline really ended that whole time, and I adjusted. Of course, now I've accumulated things again.
Maybe it's time to get on a plane.
I think you're right. I think that's true. It's time to get on another plane and lose everything again.
And it's amazing how much regard we have for the things that we've collected, but how little regard we have for the things that others have collected. It seems like a holdover from some ancient time when it was important to hang on to the things that you happen to see. But now everything is plastic and there really is no necessity.
The important thing with possessions is that they are a physical representation of a mental state that you are in a particular time. Like staring at a certain object can take you back to your childhood when you were buying a plastic meal and receive a toy with it, but the toy itself is meaningless. It's once you involve yourself in meditation and allowing yourself to drift through your different mental states, the physical objects are no longer required.
Well, I wonder if I could introduce a new subject.
Please do so.
Well, I was listening to the radio and they were discussing Shabbat elevators.
Mm-hmm. That's
right. Do you
know
about Shabbat elevators?
I do. Would you like to introduce the subject, though, to our listeners who may not be familiar?
Well, I didn't know about them before, but it seems there is a building, perhaps in Israel, with 13 floors, and on the Sabbath, no one is allowed to press the buttons.
So, caller, actually, in general, many members of the Jewish faith regard initiating any electrical or mechanical device to be forbidden. So, on the Sabbath, on Shabbat, they feel that it is impermissible to push the buttons of any elevators. So, in many predominantly Jewish neighborhoods, the elevators on the Sabbath will simply stop at every floor.
Yeah.
And so, let's bring another voice in to join in on this particular discussion. Caller 3, welcome.
Hello.
It's marhaban.
How are you tonight?
We're very well, caller. Caller, we're out of curiosity. Are you Jewish?
No, sir, I'm not.
But are you familiar with the Shabbat elevator?
I'm familiar with the Shabbat. I guess not the Shabbat elevator.
Yeah. So apparently we've discovered that in predominantly Jewish neighborhoods that the elevator will stop on every floor on the Shabbat. It will go up 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, and then it will go back down again, and do this repeatedly. So that a devout Jew could simply go on to the elevator and wait until they reach the floor that they wish to go to, and then emerge without ever having initiated any sort of...
What if you had a robot that could push the buttons?
But isn't by nature the elevator already a robot?
Activating the robot itself would be an act of activating an electric device.
Well, I'm not actually sure what the dividing line is there, because I know that if I had a Jewish neighbor when I was growing, and on the Shabbat, they would ask me to light a fire for them so they could cook their food, and that was permissible, that they could ask me to do that, but not do it themselves. So I think actually the robot would be an acceptable solution. I'm not really sure why the button is not permissible. So I wonder if we had set up a code where if they threw a stone at me, I would light a fire, if that would be permissible or not.
Well, who was the first person? I mean, there always haven't been mechanical elevators. Who was the first person to conceive that this had to be this way?
I am not not sure, actually, caller. What's the history of the...
It's usually those who are very well read in the Torah and the religious works that make these judgment calls. But I believe it would be more spiritual for those who are non-handicapped to just simply take the stairs.
Well, I mean, that just is not practical. I mean, many Jews live in New York City where the buildings are 200 or even several thousand stories high. So to climb the... climb the elevator walls is, I mean, simply suicide. They would, by the time they reached their floor, the Sabbath
would
be
tomorrow.
Over. That's precisely correct.
Would this be done in New York too?
Oh, certainly.
Oh.
Or anywhere there are elevators.
And Jews together. Anywhere there
together,
are
yes.
The two of these things together.
Oh.
Precisely.
It's a mind-boggling concept to try to even think of climbing four floors with a bag of soda.
Precisely.
Especially if you're old.
And carrying a bag of soda is already very difficult. And
especially if it's not double-bagged.
Precisely. I mean, I've never actually seen soda sold in a bag. It's always sold in my neighborhoods in bottles.
Well, it would have to be bags of bottles.
Oh, I see. I thought that perhaps in some areas in New York, they sold bags
of soda.
Bag of cola.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so you could put it, it could be like a jet pack.
Right.
You could more efficiently carry a bag of soda on your back, like a jet pack.
This comes down to the question, paper or plastic. You just have to use plastic.
I always use, I like to bring my own leather bags.
Yes, a burlap sack in my case.
Leather.
I do.
Very
nice. I still have, from my first camel, it had a very large hump, and when it died, I tanned the leather, and I still use that.
Did the camel have one hump or two humps? Is there an identical bag somewhere?
No, it was... It was
a camel.
Might
be a dromedary.
I did not have a dromedary.
No,
it's a single hump. But when... that's the type of possession that I don't regard as being an attachment to the material world. It was just an attachment to my lovely Jemel. And that's all I use for carrying my groceries. Mm-hmm. You know,
and for a long time it might have carried you.
There was a time. It's sort of symbolic. And
I have a closet full of bags, not camel, but plastic or different materials, and I always forget them. I get to the store and I think, oh, I forgot my bags. So then I have to get more.
Yeah.
So you bring more and more bags everywhere.
I do. I have a closet full.
Well, how do you perpetually stock the closet if you only bring them with you?
No, she never does. So
she never does. So they just accumulate.
I get them. I get to the store and...
Accumulate more and more.
More and more bags.
And see, now it's a pity that the stores simply did not have... a leather bag that you could buy.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe it is that, you know, you would not become attached to it the way I became attached to my leather bag.
Peter might have a hard time letting you sell leather bags for food at Whole Foods Market, too.
Yeah, but I don't really see why. I mean, isn't it better for the planet?
I think you should stuff your bag.
I mean, you know, maybe it's a little gruesome, but...
I don't think so. I mean, people carry leather bags around all the time. I have a small seal pouch.
Yeah, and really, I mean, the reasoning is sound, right? That you don't want a waste of life, right? A life was taken to make a burger.
Mm-hmm.
Why not also the same
burger.
Life... you know, produced material which could be used to produce a bag.
Exactly. And it's germinating wisdom.
That's precisely right. And I think we could we could expand this further, but but I think that people would be uncomfortable with this, which is that, you know, that in some parts of America now, they are still executing people for various reasons. But as far as I know,
down in Texas, they keep their prisons filled with people.
Filled with people that are sentenced to die.
Yeah, and it's almost like a Saturday afternoon, bring the whole family sort of affair. They do it every week, every year. They kill people and kill people without, you know, thinking about, you know, what we're talking about.
So you want to use the humans for bags?
Precisely. Like, the skin is there.
Right.
It's very high quality. You know, is that... I mean, I suppose that some of the offenders have tattoos,
which are undesirable.
It would make a unique bag.
But it would be unique.
And also, right. People would be able to dye said bags.
They could re-dye the bag. I suppose.
Re-dye the bags, like different colors.
The
question is how durable such leather would be.
I'm sure it would be highly durable. It would last a lifetime.
If you cured it long enough and treated it properly and maybe didn't let it be your bag of choice in the rain.
I think the real question is, how do you feel walking down the streets of New York City with it, carrying a human head bag?
Well, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? It's the circle of life, and you're reminding yourself that one day you will become part of everything else.
Is it not better to not kill that human?
I'm not sure about that. But see now, I think that ultimately, if it is okay killing the person, then it should just be...
Okay to have the bag.
Okay to have the bag as well.
Sure.
And I mean, the human head is really ideally suited to become a handbag, if you think about it.
Or a soup cup.
Well, the thing is there is a place for a handle and a very large opening for large items. And then I think that if you use the eyes for coins...
I wonder if this is another way, instead of having a robot... I mean, this is essentially you lighting the fire. You could use your bag hand to hit the elevator button, and then someone else is hitting it.
Precisely, and they are dead, so...
This might be permissible on the Shabbat.
Only if the deceased is not a Jew.
Correct.
Oh, yes.
Well, anyway, I mean, if we are going to permit asking someone to push the button, then I'm not sure. And I would love for someone who knew about this sort of... If only Professor Levine were here, he could answer a lot of these theological questions.
Exactly.
But instead of a physical button, would a blow button be permissible? Because that's also speech. I mean, it's the same mechanism.
Well, one could accidentally sneeze into the button.
What if they just had like a RFID chip, though, and you just put it in your pocket, then they wouldn't have to touch anything.
But
and
we wouldn't be allowed to carry an
the door would
chip.
Open.
Where's Ivan?
Ivan, unfortunately, is not with us this evening. I think he is traveling.
I miss him.
We all miss Ivan.
Yes.
I sometimes, when he is around, I miss him.
That's very touching.
He's wonderful, and he's meditating constantly, but he has such a strong presence that if you just close your eyes and meditate, I'm sure you will find him on the spirit path.
I'm there.
Lovely. I'm going to say good night now. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, caller. One
Namaste.
Second.
Namaste.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Yeah, but that's really wonderful, this idea that... that Mr. Five had of having a sneeze button, where perhaps you have a little pouch of pepper or was that Aurora?
Yes, it was.
Maybe some hand sanitizer.
Right, or maybe you could
everyone's just... Everyone's sneezing all the time.
Right.
That's true. But I'm not sure if the restrictions of the Shabbat apply to you if you are ill.
Would that be anything from a common cold, though? If you had syphilis, that's one thing, but everyone gets a common cold. It seems like maybe if you didn't want to participate, you would go out and just touch every door handle in New York City.
Well, I mean, I think just about everyone's also had syphilis. I mean, it's really just a matter of scale.
True. Yes, our DNA is transformed by the effects of syphilis over many, many generations.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, but I actually meant that most of the people I know have at one time actually had syphilis.
Really?
Yeah, but it's one of those experiences that if it does not kill you, it simply makes you more interesting. And it's just how life goes there.
Mm-hmm.
But
you know, the seeds to a pumpkin, and then the pumpkin grows, and we eat the seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Then we return the seeds to the ground, and we grow another pumpkin. It could be the same as human handbags.
Precisely, a pumpkin handbag, and no less gruesome. Well, if any Jews out there would like to call in and share with us theological knowledge, we would love to hear it. It's 617-253-8810.
And non-Jews are also very welcome to call in and add their voice to the circle.
And non-humans as well.
If they are able.
Maybe a robot would like to weigh in tonight.
Well, let's bring in a voice now and see what sort it is. Caller, welcome to the air.
Hey, what's up? I'm a Jewish robot, and I just wanted to weigh in on my take on the world.
That's wonderful.
Greetings.
Thank you so much for calling in.
No problem.
So, to begin, is it permissible, as we believe, that the sneezing button, would that be considered permissible as an actuation mechanism on the Shabbat?
Well, you know, it really depends on whether your particular boogers are kosher. So if you've been blessed by a rabbi recently, as long as you don't eat shellfish or sniff lines of coke that's been, you know, around pigs, then you should be fine. But, you know, there'd be a lot of complications. Like, you know, how are you going to, you know, let certain people in and not let certain people in depending on their sneeze? You know, you'd have to have a sneeze testing device, too.
You are a robot. You have those functionalities, correct?
Well, I'm only really half of a robot, so...
So you're actually a Borg?
Well, I prefer the term cyborg, so...
A cyborg?
I don't want to get into the whole thing, but, you know...
Well,
kind of racist to say Borg. I'm not in Star Trek.
Certainly, certainly, Connor.
Yeah, no, we didn't mean any offense by that comment.
I know you didn't.
No, but I actually did. Now, now the birth ceremony. No. Let's go back to the Shabbat rules. Is a hand fan permissible on the Shabbat?
A handstand. Yeah, as long as you're not standing upside down on a pig or shellfish, and you don't sneeze.
What about a hand-operated fan?
A hand-operated fan is fine as long as the money that you paid for it doesn't come from Nazi industry. So even, you know, anything from, you know, Schindler elevators, you know, that came from Arthur Schindler, who was like, I don't know, he was like a Nazi or something. So you can't, you know, if you made a lot of stock money from him or his elevators, you can't buy a hand fan with that and expect to be able to use them.
Right. Obviously.
That's a connection that I never made.
He was an accountant, though.
Yeah, he was an accountant who made elevators and escalators in Nazi Germany.
What relationship between the Shabbat and maybe escalators? We've talked a lot about elevators, but you know, wouldn't that be more preferable to just install escalators that went up through every floor in New York City?
Absolutely.
We would have to talk about
that's what
robot
a Shabbat elevator is.
More extreme Jews don't walk or move on the Shabbat because they believe that any expenditure of energy is, you know, an antithesis of what God intended. So, by resting. So they kind of just... I actually have a friend whose name is Daniel McGreensteinberg, Steen, and he has a flotation tank installed inside his bed. So when the Shabbat comes, 12 o'clock Friday night, he just opens up the trap door on the bottom of his bed and just sinks down to his flotation tank. And he has his Roomba bring him drinks, and he doesn't eat because digestion is also kind of a type of work. So.
But yeah. I wonder if telepathic chess is permitted.
I'd say as long as you're not making money from it, or, you know, as long as your partner doesn't eat shellfish or pigs, then I think you should be set.
So I've noticed that's a recurring theme. Is there any reason? I must confess that in spite of a great knowledge on teeth and transdermal mediation, I know very little about Judaism.
I'm sorry, was there a question?
Yeah, why the recurring restrictions regarding shrimp, pork, and shellfish and other items?
Well, okay, so if you look back to the Bible, to the Old Testament, which us Jews believe in, there was a lot of warring in Israel and the Promised Land for a while after Moses landed there in his ark. So for a while, for about 300 to 400 years, the people of Judea or Israel Jew were subsisting purely on pork and shellfish. And after they won the battle against the Moors for Israel and Spain, they decided to never eat that stuff again because it had bad memories attached to it. You know, kind of like how Jews don't use gasoline now because it reminds them of Hanukkah. So that's basically the reason. It's more complicated than that, but
that's interesting. But, you know, going back to the elevator and the escalator, isn't the use of all electricity forbidden as one of the 39 categories of work? So how does one get to the 38th floor of a building if an elevator by its nature is an electrical device, regardless of...
Well, perhaps one should not attempt to travel to a 38th floor on the Sabbath. According,
but what if that's where you live?
No one lives on the 38th floor.
You would have to exert energy to leave the 38th floor.
Well, perhaps you would have to get up there on the Friday and then after sundown.
I think actually the greatest solution to this problem is to start out the Shabbat on a very, very tall, spiraling sled, and then simply spiral down for the day. And then that way you are not expending any work or even causing work to be expended. You are actually wasting energy. But you will go through the desired motions of a normal day that way.
Be like a Jewish Willy Wonka.
I mean, I have a Segway myself, so I don't actually have to walk or move really much at all on any Sabbath. And, you know, of course there's work being done inside the gyroscope or however it works, but, you know, as the Jews have been saying, electrons are actually little pieces of Yahweh, so we're not doing the work at all. It's actually God who's doing the work for us, paying us back for giving him a chance to rest on the first Sabbath, which was Friday the 13th, which was kind of freaky.
So the Segway is actually permissible?
Oh, yeah. Segways are permissible, just as elevators and escalators are permissible. And, if you happen to be on a cruise ship or something, that's absolutely permissible, because you're not driving the ship, it's God. So
what if we had magnetic cars, then?
Or actually, yeah. even simpler, why not have on the elevator... a sensor, I mean, forgive me for asking the obvious question, but a leaning sensor so that you could then lean a certain amount and land on the 38th floor.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, the leaning is a little bit of work that you're expending, so the least amount of that possible would be great. But, you know, if you had some sort of device that hooked up to your Segway, so that if you, you know, lean forward on your Segway the right way, the elevator got that, you'd conserve leaning energy, and you'd be able to get to the 38th floor. But I think that the preferred method for Jews would probably be some sort of a transcranial magnetic stimulation device that would kind of attach to your head once you got in the elevator and influence you to not want to get to the 38th floor and just to stay where you are and be calm and you know, happy with that.
So that can also be achieved through meditation.
Right. I mean, yeah. That's the role of spirituality.
Yeah, or, you know, smoking bacon is a pretty meditative.
Right. Not everything can be electrified.
Yeah. But, you know, and that's a big debate right now is, you know, if you electrocute pork, is that fine now? Because the Jews never cooked pork before.
Right.
When they were trapped in Judea.
Right, or there's a similar movement going on in electrification of spirituality, similar to in the mid-1900s, the electrification of the guitar and...
Yeah,
it's connected to desire.
Where does that get us?
Yeah, I mean, where were all the ghosts before that? And then as soon as you see people picking up the electric guitar, you know, the next day, you know, hundreds of ghost reports. And now, everywhere are ghosts. You can't walk down the street without seeing ghosts and ghost reports.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think we should all die in nuclear warfare. And I think that's the only solution. So, that's me.
Well, such a death would require use of what I believe is an evil technology.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not evil as long as you're not eating pork or shellfish on the day that you detonate it. So that's really what it depends on. As long as you have a pure diet, you know, you can let off the power of an atom. And, you know, I think Yahweh will be pretty cool with that. He invented it, after all.
Well, on that note, callers, I'm afraid we're reaching the top of the hour.
Oh.
But do join us next week.
We will. Thank you very much for having us on the air this evening.
Thank you.
If you have a chance, just eat a cupcake this weekend and enjoy it.
Yeah. If you guys want to come over to my house tomorrow and lie in my grass, we can play some telepathic chess, but you got to fast first, so come on down.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
call
that sounds good.
Yeah.
Open invitation.
Thank you.
Great.
And to everyone else, if, you know, check out our, maybe I should say bye to my co-hosts here, huh? So thank you again, Mr. Five, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And to Aurora.
And thank you for joining me as well.
I'm Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Humans on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. We're on every Friday at 7 p.m. Check out our website at musicforhumanbeings.com or email us at humans@wmbr.org. Stay tuned for... I can't remember the name of the show, but Mr. Five may know it.
I believe it's Massachusetts Bay and Response.
Massachusetts Bay and Response. It's a new show, but it's really amazing, and I wish someday we'll be able to get the DJs onto our show. But thank you for listening. Ma'a salama.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Special lady, I think it's time for a little one-on-one conversation. Talking about my baby, baby. Not you, baby. Our baby, baby. A recent scientific studies of lactation.
Baby, you gotta know the facts, lady.
Magical lady, gonna get down.